Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk
on 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show, proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that brings you the 2021 Absa Africa Financial Markets Index. That's Africa Nacity. Absa is a registered FSP. Welcome to the Money Show. Lots to get through this evening, so I'm looking forward to getting my guests up tonight. Mike Schuster will join us first, talk about the importance of Transnet. We'll talk to Kiet van Sail, part of a really important conversation this week with the President, Cyril Ramaphosa. And I've seen a presentation that government did on the feedback that small businesses have given government, and it looks really, really positive. We'll catch up with Kevin McCullum as we wrap up our coverage this week of the Absa Cape Epic. We will also later on play the Brutal Biz quiz. But before then, a furniture manufacturer par excellence. I've just been online for much longer than I should have been this afternoon, admiring the work of Meyer van Willich. It is a furniture, South African furniture manufacturer, and makes things of extraordinary beauty. We'll do that this evening on our Friday file. And what a piece of work. Before we chat to Mike Schuster, what a piece of work Rosemary Ndlovu is, former police officer. Six murders under her belt for 1.4 million rand in insurance claims. Now, in Eyewitness News, we've heard praise lavished upon the prosecutor, praise lavished on the police investigator in this case, and that, I'm sure, is absolutely justified. But considering what the murder rate in South Africa, and I don't know what the official conviction rate is, but I'm not too sure that it's all that high by global standards when it comes to convicting murderers. I wonder about the role of the insurance companies in this particular case, because they, I'm sure, must have seen, hold on a second, there is some commonality in these cases. Here is a woman who is a constant beneficiary of people who are getting murdered, gets a bit suspicious after two, three, four, five, six victims in a row and one beneficiary. You wonder why these things don't get flagged sooner. But yeah, good news. Convicted of the murder of six relatives. With family like her, who needs enemies? Rosemary Ndlovu. Hope she goes to jail forever.
The Money Show.
With Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Interesting column today about South African coal exports and the inefficiencies at Transnet and just how much money South Africa is losing out in terms of the failure to export to our full potential. We should be exporting 8 million tons of coal a month, and we're getting 3.5 million out of our ports. Mike Schussler is chief economist at economists.co.za. And it's not just the ports, Mike. I mean, it's rail links across South Africa that are deteriorating, getting stuff to the ports, and then the ports themselves which are failing. And we know the Transnet chief executive, Portia Derby, is agitated and frustrated and desperately keen to get things moving in the right direction. But one wonders whether or not she's winning the battle to get Transnet functioning properly.
Well, I absolutely agree, Bruce. I think she's trying very hard. And, you know, other things are happening. Cable theft. I was at a Zoom meeting called these days. And Transnet's guy said that they're losing around 50 kilometers every 2 weeks of cable to cable theft. And that means the trains can't perform properly, or you need diesel trains, which are not as powerful and cost you more. We're not getting the data that I have is from the Department of Mineral and Energy Resources, showing how our exports of coal have dropped. And they've dropped severely. I mean, and it's not just due to the riots in July. It was before then. And it's likely to be a little bit up in August, but severely down again in September on the performance of the port. So we're looking at losing quite a lot of money. If we're losing the difference between 8 million and what we're exporting now, then it's probably about 5.4 billion a month. If we look a bit further and we say the price even increased in the last 2-3 months, then we're probably even at, you know, 7 or 8 billion a month in rand terms, obviously, that we're losing. And that's a lot of money over a year, because we measure most things like, you know, in financial terms over a year. And that's huge. It's not just for the coal industry to bear. That's for employers, employment, you know, the people that do contracts at the mines, and spending in the economy that's gone and that's not being prosecuted. So it just carries on. It's incredible.
50 kilometers of cable being stolen every 2 weeks. Cable doesn't, I mean, that's, I don't know, an Olympic-sized swimming pool full of cable, I'm sure. I mean, it's a vast quantity of wire. That wire is being sent to people who are stripping it down or reprocessing it and probably putting it onto cargo ships and getting it out of the Transnet's ports and getting it to recyclers in places like China. This illicit trade in recycled commodities is huge. You would think with a little bit of proper crime intelligence, one could shut that down fairly quickly.
One should be able to, but I think our crime intelligence is a, you know,
an oxymoron
offense, calling them that.
Yeah, absolutely.
But you know, I agree fully with you. I love our country. I think we have a lot of things that can go right. We're in a commodity boom. Right now, we're seeing coal prices even higher than they were in July. We should be coining it in that industry. And then there's also the iron ore industry that you can add. You can add manganese, quite a few others, all the holdups at the border for the trucks that we have at the moment taking stuff. And that shouldn't even be on trucks, and I advise the truck industry. But they go down to Maputo. So it's beyond our borders even, and we're getting very little in this commodity boom compared to other countries. And although it saved us a lot, you know, we should have been coining it even more, perhaps as much as 10, 12 billion a month more, Bruce. And that's not being, you know, over the top.
And that's just commodities. That's just commodities. That's not even the car exporters.
Motor vehicles, no,
who must be feeling it. And small businesses who are doing their damnedest to service their markets in South Africa but are looking for new global markets, they're getting stuck in this inefficiency and this catastrophe, you know, in the rail linkages, which are run by Transnet, and the ports, which are run by Transnet, which has declared force majeure twice in the last 3 months. This isn't something that can be sorted out, I don't think, in an executive office at Transnet. The problem is far bigger and far deeper.
No, I think the president has to get involved, and he has to tell his police force, arrest the people, do your damnest. And in fact, you know, we've got to start locking up people, because if we don't, we're going to damage the poor of this country. And, you know, just to put it in another context, it's not just the exporters. Remember, the exporters are part of the economy, but they buy from the guys that provide local services. So, you know, even the hairdresser, in a sense, is involved, because if the guy doesn't have money to cut his hair, then the hairdresser doesn't make money. But he would have had money to cut his hair if his product was exported. And that's just being, you know, very silly, but that's the fact of the matter. And we have to look at this in very real terms, in very, very honest appraisal of how we're doing. And if the law doesn't work, our constitution means absolutely nothing.
Sorry, Mike Schuster, we must leave it there, but thank you. If the law doesn't work, the Constitution means absolutely nothing. And it's a brutal truth. Absolutely brutal truth. Mike Schuster, thank you. The president hasn't been sitting on his laurels, though. Yes, he is campaigning. Yes, there's lots of criticism that the wheels of government have ground to a halt while politicians crisscross the country and campaign for your votes in the local government elections. But there was a call this week between entrepreneurs and the president. And I know this because I saw Kit van Sail on LinkedIn talking about it. And you were part of this meeting, Kit, with the president. I'm talking about the woes and troubles of the entrepreneurial sector. Take me through the origins of the meeting and what you think it might have achieved.
Bruce, yes, good evening. It is 10 days before the election, but whatever your political views, you have to acknowledge that to make South Africa more competitive globally, we need to foster innovation, encourage high-growth businesses to grow, to create jobs at scale, and ultimately increase the tax base. So for a number of years, some organizations in the ecosystem, as we call it, have worked selflessly and relentlessly. You know, the Digital Africa Collective, Simidisa, Saska, Endeavor, Grindstone Accelerator, Alan Gray Orbis, to name a few, the SASME Fund. And ultimately, yeah, the president acknowledging that step change is needed in the knowledge economy, in the entrepreneurial direction, to address South Africa's unemployment challenge. So reached out to a number of these organizations which are all leaders in this field and say, let's have a chat. What do you suggest? How do we take this forward?
I've seen lots of positive feedback to your message on LinkedIn this morning. I also saw today a presentation that was compiled by the presidency entitled Enabling the Growth of Entrepreneurs, a summary of input from organizations working to support entrepreneurs and small businesses. There's a huge amount of awareness within the presidency of the issues, and you would have amplified those issues to the president directly. I mean, if this guy was a juggler in a circus, he'd be juggling 100 balls at any one time. Do you think this sort of intervention, this sort of discussion has any positive long-term effect at all?
Absolutely, Bruce. There are naysayers, ultimately we do have constraints to growth in the country. If you look at it from what are these constraints, there are regulatory barriers for, administrative issues that companies have to grow. There's lack of funding available for businesses in general, but specifically for high-growth businesses. It's a bit of an uneven playing field. If you're a small business, you have the same lens of DE, employment practices, et cetera, as the big businesses have. And ultimately, there is a interesting skills gap, where in the digital economy, there's actually an undersupply of skills. South Africa having an unemployment thing. So basically having a look at what can we do? Whether it is a little bit topical for the election period or so, I do believe there is a long-term swing through on things like a startup act, a set of measures that can govern how we can help to innovate and grow and make early stage businesses contribute more meaningfully to the thing. Exchange controls, very difficult to go cross-border or for money to flow in, because it's protected here. There's limited venture capital, digital skills shortage. How do we address these things? So, it has to be addressed. Ultimately, we have amazing entrepreneurs in this country, and we need to support them for growth.
Absolutely. Kit, I'm delighted that the conversation happened. I'm delighted that this awareness is there. I'm just hoping it does translate into real tangible change for small businesses and for small business owners and for the people who empower those small business owners, people like Kit, who make funding available to those small businesses so that they can grow. Absolutely. You add that into the mix on the and Portia Darby, I think, is got her head screwed on. And I think she's absolutely understands the issues that Transnet faces. But, if you don't have a functioning support system of proper courts and proper policing, you then don't have the mechanisms that prevent the sorts of large scale, I'm going to call it terrorism, the large-scale theft that affects the direct operations of South Africa's most, the backbone of industry in South Africa, the backbone of imports and exports. On to something altogether more cheerful, frankly, and the Absa Cape Epic. And we broadcast this time last week from the start of the Epic, from the rugby fields, the sports fields of UCT, and the rain was pelting down and it was wild and windy. Sports writer Kevin McCullum, you've actually, I think, ridden the Absa Cape Epic before, Kevin McCullum.
I have done it indeed, Bruce. How are you doing?
Extremely well, thank you. Have you ever finished the Absa Cape Epic?
I did. I've ridden it once. It was back in 2012. I was part of Team Absa, which was a media celebrity team with Joel Stransky and Nico Panjo and Ilana Mayer. And I finished it once, and I didn't ride a bike for 6 months afterwards, and I haven't done it again.
And you've actually created a bit of a shrine to that moment in the Absa Cape Epic. I don't know if it's in your memory or in the memory of the Epic itself.
Yeah, I have, but it's a special thing. So there was a rider called Barry Stunder, the late Barry Stunder, who was a great mountain biker. He died in 2013. And he said if a guy comes to him and says, I've ridden a Cape Epic or two Cape Epics, he knows that guy is a true mountain biker. Now, I wouldn't call myself a true mountain biker by any stretch of the imagination. I've done a few races in my life. One of those is the Absa Cape Epic.
And how would people know that you've done the Cape Epic if they had only just met you?
It's like a boy who goes to Bishop's, I tell you.
I've got an MBA. I went to Bishop's and now I've written the Capsa Cape Epic. It's like the three tick box exercises.
Journalism at Rhodes, yeah.
Well, no. Okay, that's three out of four. But Kevin, I mean, in all seriousness, I read your column today and it was absolutely marvelous and it is as funny as anything. But you do, I think, show the true commitment of the more than 600 people who started the race on Sunday, 606 people, I think it was, and who the survivors will be coming through this Sunday over the finish line. Just take me through the trials and tribulations of what is an extraordinarily demanding, and I'm sure for those who finish it, very satisfying race.
Yeah, I've been trying to explain what it's like to friends, and basically it's like riding 200 kilometers a day on the road, but you're doing it through mud. You're doing it up hills that are rocky. You're pushing your bike. You're falling off. You've got dirt and mud everywhere. You wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning, and you're doing that every day for 8 days. And eventually, I mean, I know I take an example of the breakfast hall. On the first day, the first stage, everyone's talking. They're laughing. It's loud. Day two, it gets quieter. Day three, no one's talking. They're just trying to eat. You haven't got an appetite. You don't care anymore. Your legs are sore. This race must just stop now, please. And then come Friday, Saturday, everyone starts talking. And then Sunday is just this massive relief. But I cried. I cried like a baby when I finished.
Look, I've done I've done the Cape Town Cycle Tour, and I've done the 947, which is just roughly 100 k's on each of those, and I felt the same at the end of that. So I'm not going to be joining anybody on the Apsa Cape Epic anytime soon, not as a rider anyway. But it talks about and embodies, I think, everything that is learned over the past week, the ethos that this thing inspires. It truly is a world-class, global, challenging event. And by virtue of the fact that in a pandemic, 40% of this year's riders are foreigners who've taken the trouble to come here, I think is testimony to that.
Yeah, and it'll be sold out again. I think the lottery goes up for entries and gets sold out within an hour. I mean, you look at also the loyalty from sponsors. I mean, Absa have been involved with this for 16 years. And that's probably one of the longest sports sponsorships in South Africa. To mention Dart have been involved for a while, and Exxaro have been involved for 10 years. And they sponsor the development aspect. Now, because of their involvement, there's more young black riders in the top 50 of the Epic this year than ever before. So, you know, it's a very clever corporate business, but it's also a magnificent event that's been really well built up and has been built into a very good business.
Kevin McCallum, a great column this morning. Thank you very much. I laughed loudly and I also felt your pain. Maybe I was laughing at your pain. Anyway, Kevin McCallum, sports writer and one-time cyclist on the Absa Cape Epic.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
What a day on markets. What a day it is playing out to be on currency markets this evening as well. I've certainly been watching the Turkish lira this week, incredibly vulnerable. I've also been watching today the Brazilian real. And in the last 2 hours, I've been watching the rand, which is 3% weaker. We haven't seen a smackdown like this in a while against the US dollar at the moment at 14.84. It is 2.5% weaker against the pound at 20.38. And against the euro, 3% weaker at 17.24. And I would surmise, Andrew Bryson, who's a portfolio manager at Sunland Private Wealth, that it's all got to do with Jerome Powell, who's been speaking at the Bank of International Settlements Conference. He's been talking about the fact that the Fed is on track to begin tapering, in other words, beginning to slow down the pace of its monthly bond purchases, to slow down printing money to pour into markets, which is what have helped us through the pandemic from a financial perspective.
Hi, Bruce. Yeah, I don't think he said anything too surprising at that conference he's speaking at. He did allude to the fact that he still believes inflation is going to come back into that 2% range. And I think there's a lot of investors that aren't too sure that they quite believe him at the moment. But yeah, I mean, we've been expecting the U.S. to start tapering, as that economy has had a very strong recovery post that COVID stimulus.
And he has been talking about inflation, and the Wall Street Journal saying this evening that he was talking about supply side constraints have gotten worse. Now, in English, that means that the world's supply chains are broken. It's much harder to get product from point A to point B. We're feeling that in South Africa. We're seeing it in ports across the world. Massive dysfunction there. There was also a story on Bloomberg today, which the headline was, "Think everything's expensive now. Get ready for what's next." And they were talking about how Unilever has joined the likes of Nestle and Danone and Procter and Gamble in raising prices across the globe. And I mean, there are a handful of these global conglomerates that make just about everything we eat and wash our clothes with and our dishes with and clean our floors with. And they're beginning to push up prices. This doesn't feel like transitory inflation one bit, little bit.
No, Bruce, and I think the best example is to chat to an entrepreneur, a business owner, or someone that's potentially manufacturing something. You know, you chat to someone who is producing a product, and you hear about the costs of transporting goods. I mean, shipping rates have doubled this year. We know fuel prices are going to be going up significantly. So I guess it's very hard to sort of look at it with what Jerome Powell is saying, that inflation is going to come down from what we've seen, this very significant supply shock, which has caused this high inflation in the short term.
Yeah, and the one upside, if there is one, is commodity prices going up. And I mean, yes, that becomes inflationary in its own right, but we're a big exporter of commodities. And at one stage today, platinum was at $1,080 an ounce. We also saw the price of gold going up very, very sharply. We saw the gold price at $1,800. Really strong commodity prices. It's not so great for us on oil, but a lot of the stuff that we do manage to get through our broken port system is doing incredibly well internationally and earning us good foreign exchange and keeping things, stable or thereabouts for us.
Yeah, I mean, the gold shares are with the standout performance today, Bruce. I mean, up 5 or 6% for the big names. Commodity prices are have been high and probably are expected to remain high. So one hopes that we can continue to benefit from these elevated prices. Because certainly it's been a bit of a get-out-of-jail-free card over the last 6 months or so.
Yeah, we've had that support and enjoyed that support, and it's been incredibly, incredibly welcome. Thank you to our market commentator this evening, Andrew Bryson, portfolio manager at Sunlum Private Wealth. Also at the Bank of International Settlements conference, not only has Jerome Powell been speaking, but Lesitja Khanyaho, our Reserve Bank governor, has been speaking as well. And this is where the rubber hits the road. And Lesitja Khanyaho saying at this conference this evening in a video conference, if there is a risk in inflation becoming persistent, then monetary policy will have to adjust. So nothing new there. I mean, that is the job of a central banker. Should there be a risk that the rise of inflation is persistent and not transitory, there is no question that policy will have to adjust. And that's despite the fact that you and I feel considerably poorer and considerably worse off than we might have 2 or 3 years ago. And that's because of COVID. It's because of lockdowns. It's because of a constrained economy. It's because of lower wage increases or no wage increases in many cases, or lost jobs in many cases. The Reserve Bank is facing this huge dichotomy where it wants to support growth as much as possible for as long as possible. But if inflation comes into the system and starts eroding the value of your money, particularly in a significant fashion, then the Reserve Bank is going to raise interest rates. The next move in rates is up. The question is it in November? Is it in January? Is it in March? Or is it all three? We hope not.
The Money Show is proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that brings you the 2021 Absa Africa Financial Markets Index. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
Welcome to The Money Show. We're going to be talking to Norman Mayer in just a moment, co-founder of Mayer von Villach. It is a furniture manufacturer, and the backstory to this is just lovely as to how Meyer and von Willich met and how they started their business together and how it's going. And I spent far too much time today, as I confessed to earlier, going through their website and going through in enormous detail the glorious work that they do as South African craftspeople who trained together 15 years ago in the Southern Cape and to continue to do remarkable work. So that is Norman Meyer in a couple of minutes' time. The Brutal Biz quiz this evening, it has an element of aeronautics to it. It has an element of climate to it. It has an element of naughty bankers to it. It has an element of racing cars and property. That's as much of a clue as you're going to get from me this evening as to what is in the Brutal Biz quiz, but we'll play that game coming up in just a little while. On the next Money Show, we talk about business books and our book feature. Of course, Toby Shapshak, the Chief of Staff Studios, reviewing the latest gadgets that have grabbed his attention and everything else that you need to know about when it comes to, of course, the latest in technology. And we're going to do our Monday Other People's Money feature. That is all coming up next time on the Money Show.
The Money Show.
The Friday File.
The Friday File.
If you want to buy furniture, there's lots of choice. There's a huge amount of choice. You can go to mainstream furniture stores practically anywhere and get yourself a lovely table, some nice chairs, and you can pay a very reasonable price, probably cheaper today in real terms from the big chains, because so much of the stuff that we do buy is imported from places where it's incredibly cheaply made. I can't guarantee that much of the stuff that you buy, though, is going to be with you for the long haul. Buy cheap, buy thrice, I think the saying is. But there are a handful of remarkable craftspeople in South Africa making beautiful designer furniture. And the emphasis, thank goodness, is increasingly on natural materials. And tonight on the Friday File, Norman Meyer, co-founder at Meyer von Willich. And I'm ashamed to say, Norman, until my producers introduced me to you virtually today, I was unaware of the work that you've been doing for the last 15 years. Where did you and Aubrey von Willich meet? Earth to Norman. Now, you see, my producer tells me that Norman is on Zoom, and I have no reason to doubt her. However, I hear life. Is that a pulse, Norman? Yes, there is something happening in the background. And Norman is frantically clicking a mouse. Well, somebody's clicking a mouse. I tell you what, we're going to sort that out and be back in a moment with Norman Meyer, we hope, co-founder at Meyer von Willich.
The Money Show.
The Friday File.
The Friday File.
I've done the introduction to Norman Meyer, co-founder at Meyer von Willich. When did you and Aubrey von Willich meet, Norman? Good evening.
Hi, good evening, Bruce. Thanks for having me on your show tonight. Yes, yeah, so myself and Aubrey met roughly in around about 2004. We were students at a place here in George called Ferntech, where we studied cabinet making.
And does Ferntech still exist?
They do. They do. So they do have different branches in Cape Town, in Durban, in Johannesburg, but the college here in George closed since we left.
It's a great pity, of course, but I'm glad that there is still that level of technical training going on. I mean, was it a rigorous course? Was it a course that set you on your own course, of course, to what you're doing today? Did it give you all the skills you needed?
Yes, you know what? I mean, I think without Ferntech, we wouldn't be where we are today, because we had the opportunity of first of all studying there, or training as cabinet makers. But then also after we finished our studies, we had the opportunity to work out of the workshop for 2 years to get our business going. So they called it incubation, and so it was a way of getting new businesses going. So we are very thankful to them, because we wouldn't be where we are today without them.
So did it teach? It taught more than cabinet making and the practical aspects. There was actually business training in there as well, because I was curious as to how two young guys with a certification from a technical training center go out and start their own business and grow it to the extent that you two have.
Yes. Yeah, you know, Bruce, so, I mean, the course was really focused quite a lot more on the technical side, you know, cabinet making, which is great. So I think because we had the opportunity of starting our business out of the premises, you know, we were able to, you know, learn through the School of Hard Knocks, you know, to get the business going. But with their support, you know, we were able to get through those first 2 years. But besides that, we also had the opportunity to study through Ferntech, which had a, you know, an agreement with the University of British Columbia. So we were able to do a great furniture design course, which was online, and which really helped us a lot.
And then, so you leave Ferntech and you graduate, and you and Aubrey von Willich then decide to set up your own business. Do you stay in George? I mean, it is, of course, George and Knysna, the epicenter of South Africa's hardwood natural forestry for 4 generations.
Yes, I must say we count ourselves very lucky to be able to stay in the garden region, also be able to have our, you know, our design studio and workshop over here in George. So, yes, after we left Ferntech, we then started our own thing. You know, it's been about roughly about 15 or 16 years. And my partner, Aubrey's got a great talent with design, and so he really kick-started the whole furniture range today, which we call, you know, our signature range. And, you know, that's how we started off, you know, with our furniture range, and that's expanded now into also kitchens that we do here in the Garden Reach area. But also we do have quite a specialized, you know, one-off art pieces as well that we do make. So we've got quite a wide spectrum of clients that we have, you know, from homeowners, hotels, game lodges, interior designers, architects, and then also art collectors.
It's an astonishing catalogue, and I was going through the online catalogue and just having serious FOMO, furniture FOMO, if you can have such a thing, and just looking at the cabinetry, kitchens and bathrooms and walk-in cupboards and all sorts of glorious things. It really is a very impressive portfolio. When you started out, I mean, what were you just making tables and chairs? I mean, I say just, it's a hell of a thing, but were you making that sort of furniture and evolved then into the sort of home finishes?
Yeah, you know, because we were quite young when we started the business, I think besides starting the business, we still had to almost find our own, call it design language, that we had to really zone into. So, I mean, the first item, if I recall now, that we made that's part of the range now is part of the range called Umtomi, or Umti actually, which is a bar chair, which has got beautiful curves. And, you know, that was the first item that we made that really got noticed. And, yeah, so that was really the beginning of the whole story.
How do you source your wood? Because, I mean, natural hard woods are in increasingly short supply all over the world. How do you source it?
Yeah, so, Bruce, it's quite important to us that we use, you know, FSC-certified timber, which is Forestry Stewardship Council. So it's sustainably harvested wood. So, you know, at the moment we work a lot with American hardwoods, so oak, ash, walnut, and then also some African species. So we buy them from, you know, the local timber merchants that can either import them or that get harvested in Africa. So, but it's all sustainably sourced.
And are you, I mean, in the same way as a great chef will go to the market and not know what's on the menu for tonight's dinner until they've been to the market and said, okay, those fish are fantastic and fresh. Those vegetables are brilliant. Tonight's recipe is going to be what I've got at the market this morning. I mean, when it comes to choosing wood, are you that particular? Do you have to be that particular when it comes to wood selection?
Yeah, look, I think we obviously see a bit more in the wood than the average person, so we are quite particular about what type of wood we choose. You know, so the wood is quite carefully selected for each item that gets produced. You know, you might use a different piece of wood for a chair than a table. So you really have to then start, you know, going through your wood pile to find the right timber that you really want to use for that piece of furniture. And then I think besides that, you know, quite often because we like to work with the character of the timber, you know, we are quite particular about what type of timber or what plank we would use, you know, on a given furniture piece.
You've got a strong online presence. You talk about some of your work ending up all over the world. You've got an active global marketing drive as well?
Yeah, so we have a fantastic team that's based in Cape Town, a marketing team, Carlo and AJ. So they really do a great job with marketing, you know, the furniture locally in South Africa, but also globally. So at the moment, a lot of our market is still in South Africa, but slowly but surely we are, you know, getting a bit of traction overseas, especially in America at the moment.
Isn't that amazing that, I mean, you'll import the wood from America, come all the way to South Africa, then work it, make it into something glorious, then pop it back on a ship and send it home again? Don't they have cabinet makers and carpenters in America anymore? I mean, what is the opportunity for you that allows you to do that?
Yes, I think, I mean, it is true what you say. It is, I suppose you could almost say it is ironic, but I think our strength really lies in the design. So I think even though, you know, the timber comes from America, I think people are after the unique design that we create, and so I think that's what makes it quite unique, and so I think that's why it's so sought after overseas as well. You know, it's got a bit of an African feel to it, or an African story, so I think you know, there are always clients that are looking for something that is quite unique.
On the line from the Garden Route this evening, Norman Meyer, co-founder at Meyer von Willich, furniture makers in George in the Southern Cape. Thank you very much for joining us this evening, Norman. What a lovely story of two artisans who are making an enormous impact on the world. And then I just looked up FernTech, by the way, and they've got 7 training centres still. The one in George doesn't exist anymore, but they've trained over the years 7,250 people, of whom Norman is one. And those 7,250 people, of them, 432 have created small and medium enterprises, creating jobs for other people as well. So the sort of technical training, this technical knowledge is incredibly, incredibly valuable. In a moment, we're going to wrap up the first hour of The Money Show by playing the Brutal Biz Quiz. And by now, you know the rules. You have to dial the numbers. Either 021-446-0567 or 011-883-0702. And then you need to answer the first question. And that wins you the right to answer a second question, which, if you get right, earns you the right to answer a third. You understand how it works. Okay, easy peasy. First question in tonight's Brutal Biz Quiz. What is the name of the company that manages most of the big airports in South Africa? The name of the company. It's a state-owned enterprise. What is the name of the state-owned enterprise? The company that manages the airports in the country. I would like to know the name of that company, please. And a couple more questions for you as well. 011-883-0702, 021-446-0567. Our lines are open. You know the answer. Give it to us.
702.
Bruce is on The Money Show.
Welcome to The Money Show, which is proudly brought to you by APSA Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that brings you the 2021 APSA Africa Financial Markets Index. That's Africanacity. APSA is a registered FSP. What is the name of the company that manages the country's airports? Refilwe in Soweto.
It's AXA Airport Company South Africa.
Airports Company South Africa. After-tax loss of 2.6 billion rand. And holding off on making any big new investments. Now, the COP in the United Nations Climate Change Conference stands for what, Refilwe? Is it A, Conference of Parties, B, Conference of the People, C, Confluence of Propagandists? The COP in the United Nations Climate Change Conference stands for which one of those three, A, B, or C?
Conference of Parties.
Conference of Parties. That is number A, and you're absolutely correct. The COP26 Climate Change Conference, due to take place in Glasgow next week. Lewis Pugh and others are there. True or false? A study suggested that severe ivory poaching in parts of Mozambique is leading to the evolution of elephants without tusks.
True.
It is true. It is true. A new study in Science magazine has found this previously rare genetic conditions becoming more common in ivory poaching. What they're seeing is 33% of elephants born since the early 1990s are being born and they don't have any tusks, which is astonishing. Fani Titi is the chief executive of Witch Bank that has found itself this week in embroiled in a tax scam. And of course, Fani Titi has made a statement to the Daily Maverick. He declined to come onto the Money Show this evening, saying that they don't believe that they have any liability. They have disclosed that there could be concerns in the past, and they don't want to discuss it. At least their lawyers have told them not to. In what year, and I'll give you some leeway on this one, Rafiel Webb, because you're doing very well. In what year did Formula One last take place in South Africa? I'll give you 3 years either side.
In which year?
Did Formula One last take place in South Africa?
Any clue?
Give you 3 years either side, Rafiel. We're in three.
It's 1993.
Did you say 1993?
1993.
I'm going to have to make you the whiz of the brutal biz quiz, Rafiel, because, and you've, again, single children, people without siblings. I'm guessing Rafiel has no siblings because he doesn't play with the other children. Rafiel, boom, bang, bash. Takes the Brutal Biz quiz and teaches it a lesson. Rafiwe, you win the right to make yourself a t-shirt saying, I am the whiz of the Brutal Biz quiz. Not many people can say that, you know. Seven times Formula One world champion Lewis Hamilton welcoming the sports expansion into the United States, but saying it needs to return also to South Africa. The last time there was a race in South Africa was at Kyalami in 1993. There have been talks that it should return, and that would be massively, massively exciting, of course. Rafiwe, thank you very much for playing. There was a racetrack, and I don't know if it was a Formula One racetrack, but there certainly was a motor racing track in Cape Town in years gone by, on the site of what is now a prison, and it was called the Polesmoor Racetrack. There was a racetrack, a car racetrack, and I think probably 50, 60 years ago. The Polesmoor Racetrack, it was legendary by all accounts. Anyway, that is it for the Money Show first hour this evening. In a moment, we'll be back with the best bits of the Money Show, including a discussion with Warren Ingram, including a discussion also on this week's big stories, our favorite stories, your favorite stories on the Money Show this week after Eyewitness News.